we are and remind us that there is so much more. We get invited into the other side of the veil and find his presence there, and it's always good. So thanks for just letting us all worship him together this morning. Great joy. Great joy. It is true. I do just wish to acknowledge it again. So 41 years ago, we were crazy enough to say I do. Crazy enough to say I do. I find it interesting that I am going to today to speak on the puzzle of peacemaking at home on my anniversary. And so, you know, that's kind of unique. I don't think I've ever delivered this message on our anniversary before, hon. So maybe I'll be preaching to the choir. Of course, I usually am preaching to the choir and myself while I share. But, you know, when I did the Mosaic series, I loved the idea of little pieces that compose a picture and give us an idea of what this vibrant church is supposed to look like. Why am I preaching peacemaking under the puzzle of it? Because I just want to let you know there is a challenge of fitting the pieces together sometime. But when we do get it done, it is this great moment when the puzzle is complete and we take great satisfaction in it. I don't know who it was, but there were people that snuck into our hotel room last night and left chocolates on the pillow. Thank you. There was a wrapped present. There's a game, a card game that we actually happen to love, and our cards and that version of the game are so worn out they don't even shuffle well anymore. So there was that. That was just a joy. And then there was a slightly larger box, and Cheryl just kind of giggled when she picked it up because it was a 300-piece puzzle. And it is something that sometimes we just get totally obsessed about, making puzzles and doing that. And there were people just kind of blessed us. So for those who did that, thank you. But talking about the puzzle of peacemaking at home is a great place to begin. I kind of laid groundwork last week why we need to talk about peacemaking at all. And I think it's valuable. And I want to let you know that today, if you are single, if you know, you are married, if you have a business, if you work somewhere, I don't think that we can totally talk about peacemaking and not have it lap over into other things. So whatever your life situation is today, I want you to expect that there will be things that will come up in any one of the given messages on peacemaking that will apply to your life in the here and now, whether it is exactly. So in other words, if you're a teenager today and you're not married, okay, let's just assume the day may come. But I want you to realize that as a teenager today, you may learn a thing or two that really helps you figure out how to get along better with mom and dad. And know that that is the case. And that is one of the unique things about the puzzle of peacemaking, is it kind of laps over onto other things. So peacemaking at home, the word peacemaking is significant. It's not peacekeeping. Peacemaking is what Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. It's this active thing that we create. It's not something that we discover. It's not something that just happens, but peacemaking is something that we do. How do we bring peace back to the home when something causes it to become other than that? That's what peacemaking is. And so we will own the fact again. There was the quote that I shared last week that, you know, the average, at least once a week, the average couple has some type of conflict at home. There's that, wow, that often. And, you know, it's 2.5 hours that the average employee finds himself in some type of conflict at work in a given week. Those are just realities. Those are things that other people have studied and looked at. That's the challenge of some of this. So we look at it and we just acknowledge the fact that let's just imagine that let's just for a moment, I know it's hard to believe, that Cheryl and I had conflict this week. And I'm just going to imagine, as hard as it is to believe that somebody else in here had conflict this week, and we don't need to confess it, and we don't need to be embarrassed about it. It is something that is a part of our brokenness and the results of the fall in our life. It is a part of us. So this morning is all about how do we begin to do that. I loved a TV show, and I still use it. I've used clips from this TV show in many retreats. But I just love it because I just think it's a great reality picture of sometimes, despite the fact that we deeply love our spouse, there are these moments that are a little bit tense. And I just, well, I want to play one for you. This needs video audio.
Why didn't you say that instead of giving a big speech about how you have nothing?
I did.
When did you say, excuse me, I just need some space right now in my office?
When I sighed.
You sighed?
Yeah, I went.
What? I'm supposed to know what that means?
Yes, because when you went, I gave you the bathroom.
I never went.
Oh, come on, you practically fogged up the mirror with your. Meantime, you didn't get the message, even though I had to go.
Okay, fine.
Well, give me a second. I'm a little dizzy.
If I did sigh, I didn't mean anything by it.
Oh, no. I know you too well. I know exactly what it meant. It meant, you smell, get out.
Ray, you may smell, but you offered to leave.
Well, I didn't mean it.
Well, why did you say it?
I was being nice.
Well, this should be a little lesson for you. You should always mean what you say.
And you should always mean what you sigh.
You want to know why I sigh? It's like a pressure valve, a release. Living with you, if I didn't sigh every once in a while, I would explode.
Oh, whoa, you think that you're so easy to live with?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think I'm very easy to live with.
Ha! You are so wrong. Open up the window and let some of the wrong out. You have so many annoying habits.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Okay, you know how, when you read your magazine in bed and you lick your fingers before you turn every page?
So?
I hate that.
Get out of here!
Yes, because you slurp your finger.
Slurp? This is not a slurp.
Oh, it's a slurp, okay? It's right next to my ear. And then you take your wet thumb and you put it on the page, which, by the way, is disgusting.
Oh. I'm sorry I'm disgusting you while you're trying to clean your toenails with a hanger.
Yeah, the only reason I did that was to see if it works, okay? And it does. For the big toe.
Okay, fine. And I lick my finger when I read a magazine. If that's all you got it pretty good.
No, oh, I got plenty more, sister. I got plenty more. All right? How about the way you sneeze?
What is wrong with the way I sneeze?
No, because you don't sneeze. You try to stop it. You know how annoying that is? Not to mention you could blow out your eye that way.
And how would you like me to sneeze?
Well, like a person, just let it go. A person goes, choo! Not, neat!
Oh. So I should just let it go and spray everything like you. You sneeze like it's a big Broadway musical finale. Ah-choo! Ah-choo! Ah-choo!
Okay, why do we laugh at things like that? And I want you to know, it's because, though maybe it wasn't about that, we got stories. We got stories of when our conflict at home or our conflict with others sometimes looked as dumb, as pathetic, as humorous, and we look back at it and just go, oh, wow. And so our goal today is not to point the finger at anyone and say, gosh, you're terrible, but our goal today is to own the fact that everyone needs continually to sharpen their skills in dealing with conflict because it's one of the challenges of being in any type of relationship. So today we're just going to continue to unpack that, and I want to take us on a journey together. Now, it's interesting that the Apostle Paul, who was never married, writing to a pretty vibrant church, area of churches, he considered this whole conflict at home thing significant enough that he actually is worried about churches and people within the churches not dealing with it well enough. And look what his concern is. I don't want to see the enemy to get a foothold. You see, because when we are handling conflict poorly at home, guess where else we'll handle conflict poorly? At work, in public, at church, around others. It's a reality. And Paul understood that, wow, this is a foothold. The enemy can gain ground against us and how we end up using, well, our abilities to either deal with conflict or to perpetuate it, our ability to make peace happen. So look what he says. It's in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 to 27, and it's a passage that I guarantee you've heard somebody preach to you before. It's a passage that in some Bible study many of you have heard. It's in a book you've read, and I'm going to challenge you today with a point that you're probably going to go, huh, never thought of that before. See, because sometimes passages are familiar, and because we can quote them or somebody else has talked about it before, we tend to think, okay, I get this whole thing wrapped up. Well, maybe that's the case, but every once in a while, I believe the Holy Spirit wants to get close, climb up in our lap, and point out, you know, tapping on our heart, you know, you've missed this point. You've missed this point. Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, he said this, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. Do not give the devil a foothold." He's writing to husbands and wives. In your anger, don't sin. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Now remember in the first church that we were at, as I was on staff at, my lead pastor didn't give us a choice. He said that Cheryl and I had to join one of the marriage enrichment coupled groups. And I said, okay, we'll go, because we were into marriage enrichment. We thought that would help. We had at least, you know, had one conflict by at that point in our life. So we're going to go. And I remember the couple that were leading the group were very quiet, introverted couple. And in that moment, while she's talking to us about how to deal with conflict, she'd quoted this passage, and she said, this is what you need to do. So the next time you're upset with your spouse, you need to sit down. She did it this way. She said, you need to sit down, knee to knee, and toe to toe, and just talk it out. And I said, if I was really angry with my wife, I would not want to be that close to her. They were appalled by this. And then I had to explain. In my growing up experience, when people in my house were really angry, it was physical. So if I was really angry, I don't want to be close to anybody I really love, because I would never want that to happen. They were stunned and shocked by it. Because we have this mistaken idea that Christians deal with conflict differently than the world. The truth is, conflict, when it occurs in the church and with believers, looks just as broken as it does in the world. And we have to be willing to admit, wow, there are times in conflict where I don't reflect the character of Christ. Paul is so concerned that the church understand this and get this right, because he recognizes a whole bunch of things. I want to unpack just these two verses this morning, because I think these two verses help us understand the process families can work at resolving conflict at home. Understanding some of the things we're going to share today gives us more tools to work at resolving conflict at home. So I just want to unpack these two verses, and I want to go through it. It starts this way. It says this, in your anger, actually uses the Greek word orge. And at that point, it means when the strong emotions you feel when you believe your right or your privilege is being threatened. Now, what we tend to do is we lighten that, but that's the word he uses. In your anger, in your orge, the emotions, the strong emotions you feel when your right or your privilege or you what you want is being threatened in some way. It's those emotions that come up. We're great in the church at making statements like, well, I don't get angry. I don't get mad. Well, sometimes I'm frustrated. I'm not mad. I'm just annoyed. The truth is, Paul said, in your anger, and he assumed that people throughout Ephesus in those vibrant house churches were going to struggle with anger. It's the assumption he makes. Believers were going to get angry. I've had individuals tell me, well, he didn't mean that. He didn't mean that because the only anger that's allowed that a Christian should ever feel is the righteous anger that Jesus Christ had. Paul doesn't say that. Paul says when those emotions, those strong, deep emotions that come up in you, when you feel your rights have been stepped on, your privileges have been stepped on, your desires have been stepped on, when you feel threatened in some way, that whole stuff that churns up inside you, when that happens, I'm teaching about that moment right now. That's what Paul was writing. So he assumes that anger is going to happen. I find that fascinating because I think within the church, we are really great at denying the fact that anger, we get angry. We will describe it all sorts of other ways, but we struggle to admit there are times that that really makes me angry. Because we think, wow, I can't be a Christian if I am angry. Do your due diligence later. Go read how he describes these great group of people in Ephesus. There's nothing real negative in this letter. He praises them. He talks about them seated with Christ in heavenly places. This is your position with him. And then he says, and in your anger, now learn some things. Wow. To the people that are experiencing every heavenly blessing they can possibly experience, now in your anger, wow. We need to not be in denial that there are times we're not good at this, that it will happen. Anger happens. The first step in peacemaking is to admit everyone gets angry. It is the first step. Until we can do that, we struggle with peacemaking. First step, Paul said it right there, in your anger. He goes on in this passage. He says, in your anger, what? Do not sin. Now, here's a question for you. If he says, in your anger, do not sin, he implies this. I can be angry, but not sinning. I can be angry and sinning. I should throw John Camperman under the bus. John, stand up and teach. What's the line? What's the line? How do I know when I've crossed over from I'm angry and not sinning to I'm angry and sinning? You're head elder, right? Well, I'll give you help. Mike can help me out. What's the line? I went years in the church and nobody ever talked about the line. But I read this, it says, in your anger, don't sin. So Paul understands it's possible to be legitimately angry and not sinning. And it's possible to be legitimately angry and sinning. And I would go to marriage enrichment groups and I would ask the question, because, you know, I ask questions. You know that about me right now, right? That's the guy, picture me in the group. What's the line? What do you mean? What's the line? Well, it's when we're angry like Jesus wasn't. What's that look like? Well, and we are terrible at identifying the line. We're terrible at it. We wrestle with it. We struggle with it. We just really struggle with this concept. How do I identify the line? Where do I go with this? So Paul's statement not only implies that when we get angry, it's possible to become angry and not sin. Wouldn't that be something to desire? Oh, God, teach me that when I'm angry, teach me what it looks like to be angry and not sin. What does that look like, God, in the most precious relationship I have on earth, the relationship I have with my spouse? Oh, God, teach me what that looks like with my kids. Oh, God, teach me what that looks like with my mom, my dad, my grandparents, with whoever. Oh, God, teach me that. Teach me that. We ought to want to know this. What is the line? What does that look like? How do we get there? Now, here's an interesting thing about the Christian church today. We are very familiar with languages of love. There were a couple of different writers that came out. They were Christian counselors. They were family counselors, marriage counselors. They came out and they talked about languages of love. How many in here been to a study or you read a book on the languages of love? Raise your hand. Get them up. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we did that. Did the whole thing. And it's on there. And I want to let you know that you can't go to a single spot in the New Testament that tells you these are the languages of love. But we bought it and we believe it because it aligns with Scripture. So I always wanted to know, well, what's the line? Scripture doesn't say exactly what the line is, but, well, there's some things that counselors know that might help us indicate. So just like how every individual, this is what the language of love teaches, it teaches that every single individual is wired differently by God, and it's impacted some by our environment, but we're wired differently, and our environment impacts it, and we are wired to respond to certain love languages. That's what it's like. We acknowledge that. I've used it in premarital counseling for years. But in my premarital counseling, we also talk about the weapons of our warfare. We talk about weapons. We talk about anger styles, which counselors talk about also. We talk about it from this perspective, in the same way that we believe every single individual was wired by God and emerges in their life a certain language of love. It's impacted by the environment. In our brokenness, every single one of us is wired for a different anger style, a weapon of our warfare, if you will. Now, I call them weapons, and here's why. So if you are in law enforcement and you are called to let's say you're called, you're in law enforcement, you get called because people have been out, there's a party someplace, and people are arguing, it seems like there's this fight that's breaking out, and two police officers show up, and there's a lot of loud people, there's a lot of angry people, but nothing's going on. Police officers are there, they're vigilant, they're watching, they're talking, they're trying to bring this back to a state of peace and end it. At that point, the police officer is in a vigilant posture, has a weapon on his side, might have a taser on the other side, but his hands are not there. They're very clear. We're taught this. Taught this in the military when we did boardings. However, someone at that confrontation that's going on at that party suddenly picks up a cue stick. Somebody picks up a bottle and breaks it. What does the police officer instantly do? Hand goes here. Instantly. Why? The weapon brought out by the other person just escalated the situation. The response of the officer is his weapon. That person with the weapon comes closer. What does the officer do? The weapon is now drawn. I call these things weapons because when they come out, they instantly escalate the anger situation, the conflict that is occurring. In all our years of doing premarital counseling and all our years of doing family counseling, we have never shared the six weapon styles and had a couple or an individual sit there and say, nope, that's not me, I'm none of them. No, that's not true. One person, and she was pretty deluded. One time, I forgot about that. Won't say the name. Did think of somebody. But most people will sit there and they'll go, uh-oh. That's me. So I just want to talk to you. These are things that Christian counselors talk about concerning anger and conflict, anger styles. I call them the weapon of our warfare, and you'll understand why deeper into the message. Let me just go through the six. So the first one, the first two are very in-your-face weapons, anger styles. There are people that are called exploders. They're loud. They yell at you. They might cuss at you. They might be, you know, exploders at their worst. Throw things, hit things, break things, hit people. Exploders say things like this. I wouldn't do that if you didn't. I wouldn't be like that if you hadn't. If you wouldn't do that, I wouldn't do that. And they make their explosion, try to pin it, the fault for it, on the other person. They explode. And like exploders, you know, I use the word exploders for that because, you know, if you throw TNT in a room, it blows up and it's over with pretty quick. And exploders often feel really good after they've exploded. They get over it pretty quick. Except there's the problem of what happened. You just blew up the room. There's all this other thing. And people, exploders tend to think that other people will deal with anger quickly, but other people don't necessarily deal with anger quickly. But exploders are like that. I now work with youth. Many of them have come from exploder families, and many of them have adopted the styles of their parents. Exactly what it's like. They grew up in a family that screamed, yelled, and hit each other. So guess what they do? They scream, yell, and they hit each other. Why? Because we are a little bit wired, and some of these are impacted environmentally. But they're exploders. Exploders are the style, the most aggressive style, and the church is always really quick to condemn those people. We know, oh, you can't be yelling at somebody when you're angry. That's ungodly. I'm going to argue all six of these are ungodly. Exploders. In your face, anger style. Here's the second one. Accusers. Accusers make statements like this. They sound like this. You did that because. You always do that. You'll never do that. Accusers speak in generalities that are not true. They make statements. You never pick your clothes up. You always leave them there. I don't care who it is, that's probably not always true. At least one point somebody picked it up. That's my guess. But accusers are quick to point it out that way, or accusers are very quick to speak to the underlying motive of why they did that. You did that. You were late because this just doesn't matter to you. You don't care. Hear what they're doing? They've drawn their weapon. It's out. And nobody has to guess about when an exploder's coming on them that you're in a fight. But every single person automatically also recognizes that when someone is leveling accusations at them, what do they feel like? I'm in a fight. The weapon is pointed and it's drawn and you're facing it. Accusers. Now here's what bothers me. In the church, sometimes we give accusers passes. We'll condemn the exploder. And the accuser, because they didn't explode, we give them a pass. The accusation, though, on the receiving end, anybody ever been on the receiving end of a lot of accusations? What do you feel like? You're being attacked. You got to defend yourself. Or you got to run away. Or you just lay there and take the pain. But you know you're in a conflict. You know you're in a conflict there at that point. Accusers. The next two of the anger styles are not as in your face. I will confess before you end. 41 years of marriage, those are my two. I grew up in a family that screamed, yelled, and yes, there were times we hit each other. Yeah. It was there. I grew up in a family where accusations flew all the time, and I go home and it's still like that. That's what life was like growing up. That's where I came. I was there. And I came into marriage with those two anger styles. Oh, God had to do some work. God had to do some work. Well, there are more anger styles. Next two anger styles. There are coffee carters. You're going to like this one. Coffee carters, they sound nice, don't they? Anybody go to a coffee house where they give you a reward card? And you buy a cup of coffee, and they give you a reward card, and they just slide it down, and it goes on there. And then when you get 10, you get a free thing. Anybody do that? Anybody do that? Some of you are old enough, when I tell I've been doing this for a long time. When I first used to teach this, I used to call this style green stampers. Now, I got some of you. Some of you are there. Oh, yeah, remember that? Them green stamps, get them in the book. And one day you take the books and you go trade it in for something really good. Coffee carters do the same thing. I actually only have coffee cards, and I would go to Sherry's Coffee House every day of the week, and I would sit down at my study. That's where I would had this table in the window. I wrote this leadership blog that was entitled The Man in the Window, and there was all this stuff and newsletters, and sometimes I'd work the whole day out of the coffee house. But I would go in and I would buy one plain cup of coffee, and I'd sit there and I'd get my refills and buy another one about halfway through the day and get my refills, and each time give them the card. And eventually my card was full. Now all I buy, Russ, all I would ever buy is just a plain cup of coffee. Except the day the card is full. Because on the day the card is full, I'm getting a grande coconut and dark chocolate hot latte with whipped cream. And that's what I'm getting. Because I'm going to trade it in for everything I can trade it in for. And coffee carters do this. As a weapon, something occurs that bothers them. They're angry about it. They're frustrated. That's okay. On the card. Something helps us later in the week. That's okay. It's on the card. Something happens 2 weeks later. That's okay. It's on the card. On the card, on the card, on the card. Eventually what happens? Card's full. And coffee carters say this. And you've heard them. Some of you know them. That's it. I've had enough. This changes or else. And they lay it all on the line. And there would be this huge thing. I've actually had a husband sitting in my office, incredibly emotional, crying. He said, I went to work this morning. My wife and I, she was frustrated about this one thing. It was a small thing. I didn't get it. I came home tonight. The house is cleared out. There's a note. And it says, that's it. I've had enough. It's over with. I'm gone. And years worth of frustrations were put on that coffee card. And she's finally had enough. And in her mind could justify rash action and do that. And she walked away. And there are coffee carters. And coffee carters, the church is totally good with. Because we mistake coffee carting with forbearance. And the two are different. Forbearance is saying, what you did bothers me, but I value the relationship way more. So I choose not to let that bother me or be held against you. Coffee carters are, that's fine. It's on the card. Because the day comes, you're trading the green stamps in. The day comes that you are trading in everything. Church is good with coffee carters. Spring cleaners. So my mom, we had this closet in our house, in the hallway, hall closet, and every year in the spring, she took every single thing out of that closet, dusted it off, cleaned it off, and then reorganized it and put everything back in the closet. I don't ever remember anything being thrown away. There were towels in there that were so thin you could read through them, but they didn't get thrown away. They got put back in there. There was medicine so out of date, it was ridiculous, but it didn't get thrown away. Spring cleaner's little weapon looked like this. Something happens, and I'm just going to make this up. Let's say that one of the things that has frustrated the husband for years is that his wife is perpetually late. Okay, so that's an issue. Got to work out. Got to figure out how that's going to go. But a spring cleaner looks like this. So one day, she's very late. He's there to pick her up. And he's frustrated. He says, you're late. And she goes, yeah, I know I'm late. But what about the time you were late? I stood there forever and waited. And he goes, what's that got to do with today? I'll tell you what it's got to do today. Last week, do you remember what you did to me? And every time the person feels like they're losing ground in the conflict, they go back to the closet and drag something back out because it's there, it's there, it's there. And if you are on the receiving end of a spring cleaner, you eventually just give up. And then the person who's a spring cleaner picks it all back up, dusts it off, put it back in, because you never know where you're going to have to put it, bring it back out again, including that last conflict is in the closet. Some of you are smiling way too much in this message. At least the elbows aren't flying. Okay. Spring cleaners. Spring cleaners. They keep a list of everything that's ever done. Coffee carters and spring cleaners, they're both list keepers. Mm. Two more. Guilt manipulators. Okay. So guilt manipulators look one of two ways. Guilt manipulators are individuals that in the face with conflict, they will always either be able to explain what they've done, and if you could just understand it from my perspective, you can understand how it's not my fault. And if you're on the receiving end of that, then you go, so it's my fault? I'll give you, this is a false guilt manipulator type thing. Oh, can I share ours? The classic one. They already know I'm an exploder and accuser. My wife's good at this. Her mom was better, but she learned it. I'm going to share, can I share the one in college? The TV one. I can share that one? My wife's going to let me share this. All right. So, got permission. So, a little bit of our dirt. You're going to hear more of our dirt. All right. So, we're in college. I'm going to school full time. I am pastoring in a church, and I'm working in a restaurant. Life's busy. My life's always been busy. I'd come home late at night, and we had a 6-inch diagonal black and white TV, this massive thing. And it would sit on the coffee table, and it got like 2 channels on the antenna because we were too poor to have anything else. And I would just be tired, and my mind, anybody figure out, my mind is always going, and it takes a while for my mind to disengage at night. I don't know if anybody else is like that, but that's me. That's what I'm like, and so I have to disengage my mind, and I'm struggling with that, and so I would watch TV just for a while. When we were real young in marriage, Cheryl could fall asleep at a drop of a hat pin. I mean, you know, just she was just easy for her to fall asleep. So this one Saturday came. Apparently, well, I know because I would learn, but a Saturday came, and it's not that my wife never made breakfast, but a Saturday came where she has made this really big special breakfast. Wow, coming out, wow. Wow, what's going on? This is cool. Wow, okay, it's taking place. I look into the living room, and in the living room is the garbage can, and I knew the TV was in it because the antennas are sticking up out of the top. And I look at my wife, and I said, what, you think I'm watching too much TV? And direct quote, you said it, not me. You need to know that I knew I was in a fight. So I reached for my weapons, you know, I'm going to, you know, we're big argument over her desire to see me watch less TV at night and come to bed sooner with her. My desire to want to try to unwind from everything that I was doing and what was that going to look like in our marriage, but we can't talk about it because now it becomes all about the fight. You should know the TV does not survive. It's hard to survive when it gets kicked. Fine, you want the TV because you watch TV as much as I am. Fine, you want us to watch a TV? Here, I got it out of the garbage can, kicked it. So we're going on. That's real mature, right? That's me. That's the guy behind the pulpit sharing this. We deny stuff like this in the church way too much, but it happens. False guilt manipulators will do things to try to make the other person feel guilty. They won't talk to them about what they're frustrated about. They will do things to try to make them feel guilty. Or they will construct a long story to make sure that they are not guilty. One of the best ones would sound like this. This is not ours. But so he is frustrated because a bill did not get paid, a deposit didn't get made, and checks bounced. That's a nightmare thing, okay? Money fight gonna happen after that, go on and things like that. The story was that she was going to deposit the checks. Except she went to the car, and she was going to do it, but she was late because she was doing something else for him, and she put him on the seat. When she put him on the seat, she got in the car. Her mother called, and when her mother called, she needed to talk to her mom because her mom was really upset about all these other things, and she was going to go deposit the checks that day, but she realized now she doesn't have time to go to the bank to deposit the checks because her mom has called. Her mom was so upset we had to talk about those things. So what I did, she said, I put the checks right between the seats so I wouldn't forget them that night, except I made the mistake. I put my purse on them. When I put my purse on them, the checks slid down underneath the seat. And I didn't find him until the next Tuesday. But as soon as I found him, I went to the bank and I deposited him. So you see, it's not my fault that the checks bounced. If you could see it from my perspective, no matter how long or convoluted the story is, you'd understand that it's not my fault. And if you're on the receiving end of that, you go, so it's my fault? And man, we've dealt with couples like that. Dealt with couples that struggle with those things, false guilt manipulators. Last one, silencers. They cut off, they won't speak, they won't talk. They may be loud in their silence. Some teenagers are very loud in their silence. Slam, radio up, but they aren't going to talk. And some spouses are like that. I worked with a pastor who his wife shared with my wife that he had once gone like 20 days without speaking a word to her because he was mad at her. And just assumed, well, if you don't talk in anger, it's peacemaking. Now hear me. Everybody in the room, you're probably one of those. Some of you may be good at more than one. There might be somebody in here like this one couple we did premarital counseling with, and he just kept shaking his head, and I go, why are you shaking your head? And he goes, ask her. She goes, oh, I'm a black belt in all six. We deny the fact that we have anger styles. And because we do, anger doesn't get dealt with healthily in our homes. Paul said, in your anger, do not sin. It implies it's possible to be angry and not sin, or to be angry and sinning. And here's the line. The moment you pick up your weapon style, a weapon makes it worse. When your weapon comes out, whatever the conflict is, it just became worse. The moment we pick up our emotional weapons, we have crossed the line to sin. You start accusing, you brought sin into it. You're exploding, you crossed the line. You put it on the coffee card. The moment you put it on the coffee card, you crossed the line. You added it to the list of everything that's in the closet. You crossed the line. The moment you decided you wouldn't talk about it, you crossed the line. The moment you decided you would manipulate the situation to get your way, you crossed the line. Paul said, in our anger, do not sin. And I am totally convinced in the crisis counseling that we've done throughout our ministry career that the first step is owning the fact that we use anger weapons. And when they come out, the situation always becomes worse. Now, if you're a parent here, you've probably already seen it in some of your kids. You're already, you know, if you think about each other, you know, what's interesting is we want to point out the other person's anger style really quick, but I want you to own your anger style. Because that leads to the next thing that we're going to go to. Oh, what happened there? Okay. There we go. Next point, in your anger do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. This is another major implication that Paul makes. He makes an implication that dealing with anger, not the solution of all conflict, but dealing with the anger that's being stimulated by the conflict that's currently occurring, can be dealt with in a relatively short period of time. That's his implication. in your anger, don't sin. Don't let the sun go down while this is occurring. That implies it can be dealt with in a relatively short period of time. How does that happen? How does it get dealt with? Two things. First, confession. Admitting that whatever's going on, we've made the matter worse by bringing our weapons into play. Scripture talks about soft answers turning away wrath. Most of you, when you got married, probably somebody read the chapter on love. I know chapter on love, if you go back through from this message and go read the chapter of love, you'll see that Paul, when he writes about love, every single opposite of the anger weapons are written in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 and following. Yeah, isn't it there? You remember, you know, he says that, be slow to anger. Don't you say things like this? Love keeps no record of what? Keeps no record of wrong. They're there. First step in bringing the conflict under control, the first step towards peacemaking, is admitting that if we have brought a weapon into play, that we brought a weapon into play. It's being able to look at your spouse and say, honey, I'm sorry. We need to stop. I've made this worse. My weapon is out. My weapon is out. It's really awkward if you're a coffee carter or a spring cleaner because you got to go to your spouse someday. Honey, you need to know I've been holding something against you, and I shouldn't. I've used my weapon against you. I put something on the coffee card. Forgive me. I put something in the closet. Forgive me. Confession and forgiveness. Seeking and giving and receiving forgiveness. This is at the heart of peacemaking in our homes. Forgiveness is a blessing to be discovered in conflict. Hear that. Forgiveness is a blessing to be discovered in conflict. Paul said this, same book, just a little bit further. Same chapter, a little bit further. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. He's writing to married couples. He's writing to people who love each other. Why is he writing that? Because it's easy to forget because we get so consumed with weapons. Do you know why I showed that video? Their fight became all about the weapons. He was spring cleaning. She was making accusations. He switched to accusations. They were both exploding. Man, it was going on and on. Coffee carton was taking place. Everything was coming out. They were showing, except silence. Every manipulation was everything. Every other weapon was being displayed there before you. And here's the truth. My guess is sometimes you have had fights that got really ugly, conflicts that got really ugly. Maybe you don't like that word fight, but a conflict as a couple that got really ugly, and it became more about the weapon than the reason, the issue. Man, if you live with an accuser or a spring cleaner, it's easy to get wrapped up in those things, and suddenly it's about all those other things, and you forget what is actually really bothering you there at that point. There is something very healing about being able to say, hun, okay, and maybe it's 2 days later. For a lot of couples, we say it's this way. You know, you've come to your senses. It's 2 days later. Maybe you need to own your weapon. Maybe it's going back to your spouse 2 days later, and you got to say, Cheryl, the other day when we were really struggling, I know I made it worse. I just was struggling. So I was making one accusation after another. And I know when I do that, that just fuels the argument. Forgive me. I know that when my weapon comes out, it hurts you. Because that's what a weapon's supposed to do. Forgive me. Forgive me. I brought my weapon to bear. I crossed the line. And seeking and extending forgiveness is a blessing to be discovered. We've got to get better at it. The goal is to bring the anger to an end. A soft word turns away wrath, but a harsh word does what? Stirs up anger. We need to admit that sometimes we're much better at stirring the pot than getting it off the heat. in our relationships with the person that we love the most, sometimes we're really good at stirring the pot. Move towards resolution quickly. Finally, pursue resolution to avert the enemy. We want to shortcut them. That's how Paul ends this. He said this, in your anger do not sin, do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. We have to get at why sometimes we get angry. You've been married to your spouse long enough that you know when they're angry. We're just going to assume that. But sometimes we have to go back, and man, I do this all the time with kids that just struggle with anger, that they've never seen anger used positively, and I'll go, look, help me understand what you were feeling. It's obvious you were angry. You punched the wall. You called this person to this. Help me understand why you're angry. I was just angry because they disrespected me. Help me understand it. How did you feel disrespected? What made you feel disrespected? We are afraid to do that. We're afraid to go back and debrief our fights. We're afraid to go back a week later, and I always suggest to couples that are in marital counseling with us, go on a date and do it in the car after a good date, coming home, and dare to say, hey, can we talk about that fight we had about a week ago? I think I know more about why I was so upset. And then we just got to resist the urge to do anything but just sit there and listen and acknowledge. And have someone say, it bothered me so much because it made me feel like you. It made me feel set aside. See, because I had to stop myself. Because we want to say, it made me feel that you did this. Oh, it's got to be about me. It made me feel this way. It made me feel set aside. It made me feel alone. It made me feel like everything was just on me. And I know that's not what you think. Man, but in that moment, that's how I was feeling. And I think that's why it was fueling so much anger in me. We have to dare to talk about when we've been in conflict. Because if we never talk about it, we don't understand. Paul said, if we don't, it's possible to do all these things in your anger, not sin, not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and still blow the last part. Give the devil a foothold. How? Because we never dare to talk about what we were feeling in the conflict. And that's the hardest thing to do, and it's the hardest skill to learn. But it's the most important one because it's there that we finally get it. And so I use tools like this, and I'll go to a kid, and I'll go, look, give me 3 feeling words to help me understand what you were feeling besides angry. I'll do this one. I have a black magic wand that I turned on a lathe and decorated. I call it my magic wand. And I go, here's my magic wand. Wave it. And tell me what you would have had me do that would have made it better for you. And I just listen. I'll tell the kid, tell me what you would have done to make that have gone better. You know, these are working with kids. Well, you don't need to go make a magic wand for anybody. But just look at your spouse. If you could do it all over again and you could, what would you have done to help me make it better? What could I have done to help you? Have that conversation. Have that conversation that says, look, if we're ever in that situation again, it would help me immensely if this would happen. And hear those things. And sometimes we have to dare to paint word pictures. And I do this sometimes, you know, and Cheryl might be understanding why, not, I feel like maybe she's not understanding why that was important to me. And I'll say, and I'll make this story, well, hon, if this happened and this occurred, how would you feel? And then she'll go, well, I would feel this way. And I go, bingo, that's it. That's how I felt. And we're going on. We got to get better at this because we don't. And because we don't, we give what? The enemy a foothold. And if you can get a foothold at home, you think you can get a foothold at work? If you can get a foothold at home, you think you get a foothold when there's conflict in the church? We got to get better at it. We pursue resolution after the fight is over because we don't want to give the enemy a foothold. Suggestions. Practice debriefing a fight as a married couple. Days later, when you're not fighting about it, don't fight it again. Get permission. Look at your spouse, you know, because for you it may be the perfect time, but for them, you don't know, they may have just come through a really horrible day. And you look at them, can we talk about the fight we had last Tuesday? And they think, oh, not now. So don't force it on them. But if they go, can we talk about that? And you have the right to say, yes, or can we do it at a different time and name the time? You don't have the right to say what? No. You don't have the right. Because you don't want to give the enemy a foothold. So you have the right to say, yes, yeah, let's do this. This has been a bad day. Can we do this? Can we do this after dinner tomorrow? Okay. It's good. Learn to express and hear other emotions than anger. We are so good at just telling someone we're angry, but it's so bad at telling them why we're angry. Look, I'm feeling deserted. I'm feeling betrayed. I'm feeling taken for granted. I'm feeling whatever it is. We got to get better at those other things because they're at the heart of why sometimes we struggle. Learn to express those other emotions. Suggestions. Move towards compromise and agreement. This is deep stuff here. Another message. But the end, you know what peacemaking looks like? It's called compromise and agreement. Ultimately, there are things in your relationship that will always probably be a touching point, you know, maybe a difficult point. But you can learn to move towards compromise and agreement and make it so much better. Here's the goal. Make it not feel like you're always dancing in a minefield. Wouldn't it be good to know, there's a mind right there. On that thing, we got to be really careful. So if it relates to something around that thing, we're ultimately careful. But a lot of us go through marriage and it's like dancing in a minefield. We're just out there, yeah, it's good, boom! And all of a sudden this happens, and boom, another thing happens, and it's this terrible experience. And then somebody's wounded and they're hurt and they're going through it. Wouldn't it be great if we could just learn to, look, when it comes to that one, it's probably always going to be there, but let's begin to deal with it this way. Compromise and agreement. This is just the beginning. I'm doing a whole series on peacemaking, but a big part of today was to own some things. Part of what makes it difficult is we don't own the fact that it's possible to be angry and not sin. I believe, I'm totally convinced, taught it for years, I know it's true in our life. The line is when we result to those fallen weapons of our warfare and we bring those to play and those really impact our relationships. Wouldn't it be great if that didn't come out? Wouldn't it be great if I could see it in my hand and let go of it really quick? Back to the cop illustration, what's the first thing you say? Drop it. Drop it. Wouldn't it be great? Not for you to tell your spouse, drop it. But you look down, yeah, don't do that. That probably won't work. But if you look down and you realize, oh, I'm picking up my weapon. And I just let go of my weapon. And knowing as soon as I let go of my weapon, the situation de-escalates. It moves towards peacemaking. Wow. Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that be amazing? Okay, I want to end with a prayer again today. Could we pray together? Could we stand and just pray together? This one on the screen. Praying together. Lord, give me a heart of unconditional love. Lord, help me to learn to let go of the weapons of my warfare. Lord, teach me the blessing of mutual forgiveness. Lord, help me to accept my responsibility when conflict arises. No more, no less than what is mine. Lord, help me not to give the enemy a foothold. Father, might that be true in these relationships? Help us in this, Jesus, in your name. Amen. Amen. You've been patient. I admit I was long today, but I love teaching on this stuff. Hopefully, you've embraced it and it's good. Thank you for listening.